Mountains, a curious kiddo. It's time for the Green Disc with Connor Mercer on 95BFM.
That's right, time for the Green Disc. This week, Connor speaks with the University of Canterbury's Dr. Regina Izert, who is New Zealand's first and only winner of this prestigious Marine Conservation Fellowship from the Pew Charitable Trust. Regina is a field leader of Gateway Antarctica, a top predator research program in the Ross Sea. This summer, the program will be contributing to the acoustic monitoring of killer whales in the Ross Sea as part of the research for her PhD student. Connor started by asking her how the research will be conducted.
One thing that's special about whales and dolphins is that they have very complex, what we call acoustics. So they vocalize a lot and they use echolocation to find their prey and to orient themselves. And you can use those vocalizations to find out about the animals.
And so you're going to be using acoustic technology to monitor their movements?
Yes, so we can do several things. So first of all, we can build up a picture of what they do during the course of a day. So for example, do they have a diurnal rhythm the way that people do, where they get up and go to the work in the morning, they come home at night and that kind of thing. And then secondly, we may be able to distinguish individual groups of animals who have distinct calls. And then we can also monitor the presence and absence of different species, including maybe new species that we haven't seen, but we can hear.
Do you have any sort of expectation as to what a daily routine might look like? Is there already some evidence to suggest this is what's happening?
Yes, so it is very, very common for mammals and animals in general to have a daily routine, and humans have that. And what we expect to see is that there will be a daily activity pattern where they come in, possibly related to the tides. We have anecdotal evidence that the whales are more likely to come into the sound towards Scott Base during the night, and we've done a lot of our work at night, which is, of course, night down there, it's not dark, so it's just during the hours of the night.
One of the species of fish that you're going to be looking at in relation to the killer whale is the toothfish, which is obviously a hugely fished species. What are you expecting to find out here, and how is it going to help with our conservation of toothfish, killer whales, and the Ross Sea in general?
So if I can just go back a little, the Ross Sea region marine protected area that will come into effect on the 1st of December, which is a huge historic win and super awesome, is all about regulating the fishing for Antarctic toothfish and preventing any potential effects of fishing on the ecosystem. And one of the focal species for the Ross Sea region marine protected area is the so-called Type C killer whale, which is a particular type of killer whale that you get in the Ross Sea, which likes to eat toothfish.
Are we expecting to find data that might suggest that our current modes of fishing are going to be endangering to the killer whale in the future? We're going to be taking away too much of their food source?
Yes. So the basis for setting up the Ross Sea Region Marine Protected Area was protecting species that would have a direct conflict with the fisheries. And obviously those are animals that eat toothfish, such as the Type C killer whale, such as Weddell seals, such as possibly sperm whales. So a huge consideration in the design of the MPA was to keep those areas safe where the top predators feed on toothfish. And so what we're doing now is we're firming up that conjecture, if you like, and make sure we put the MPA in the right place.
So this kind of research, I imagine, must be hugely challenging working in Antarctica and working with such large animals that cover such large areas of land, aquatic space.
Yes.
What are some of the challenges that you've had to overcome in preparing for this project?
Well, there's several things. Some of them are related to the environment themselves, and some of them are related to our ability to interact with that environment. So those are quite separate. So first of all, it was all very new to us because this is the first ever research project on Antarctic killer whales that's been run by the New Zealand Antarctic Program, so we had to basically invent everything as we went. And then secondly, a big challenge for us is that we do not have any boats in McMurdo Sound, and so we have to do all our work from helicopters and from the sea ice. Now, helicopters are awesome, but we are basically stuck being on the sea ice, and we can only work where there is stable sea ice, and we're hoping the animals come to us, which they do a lot of the time.
Do you have any sort of tricks or methods you use to sort of entice the animals over to you, or is it just entirely up to them?
It's pretty much up to them, but to be absolutely honest, it's been super amazingly awesome because the first year we were there, they pretty much ignored us because they were fish-eating killer whales, so they don't really have any interest in things that are not in the water. In the second year, they sort of started looking at us, and the juveniles came over and had a look in what we were doing and standing on the sea ice. And then the third year, they actually come and say hello. They come over, and they obviously remember us from the year before, and it's just amazing.
Do you feel sort of like you're developing a connection with certain groups or pods of animals here?
Well, the one thing I can say for sure, based on photo identification, so we do a lot of photo ID work where we photograph the animals so we can recognize individuals. So one thing that's been very clear and that's come out of the work of a previous student that I had, Katya Ovsyanikova, is that we keep seeing the same animals over and over again. So it's clearly the same groups or families using the space and coming back year after year as soon as the ice breaks out.
So one of the things that this data is going to help with is installing non-invasive satellite transmitters, so moving from acoustic technology. Can you tell us a bit about this technology and what's actually involved in installing it?
Absolutely. One of my research interests is the development of non-invasive whale-borne transmitters. So at the moment, the current technology is you have two options. You either use a suction cup transmitter, which is non-invasive and non-harmful, but doesn't stay on the animal very long, so you don't get a lot of information. You maybe get a day or so. And then the second type of technology is where you basically shoot a barbed harpoon into the whale, and that anchors the tag. Now, I have huge ethical issues with that. And I will not use that technology. That, of course, provides very good data because the tag stays in and on the whale for weeks at a time, so you get a long data set. But to me, at least, this is not a price worth paying.
You're saying that you're seeing the same animals returning year after year. There's some sort of relationship, in a sense, developing here. Would you expect that if you were using this harpooning technology, that would damage the chances of these animals returning to the same site the following year?
I'm a scientist, so I'm not supposed to speculate, but what we have seen is we have seen animals with significant injuries left from tagging, not done by us, done by others, and I cannot imagine that you could hurt a large, intelligent predator and have them not resent that. Because don't forget, if you put a tag in, it doesn't just hurt when it goes in, it probably hurts all the way until it comes out again, whenever that is.
You've been listening to The Green Desk with Connor Mercer on 95 BFM.
smiling bay, full of green boys young and tall, the sons of men, make guns out of sticks that fall. I will be powerless, I'll be a wound that tills the ground, before I laugh again, before I listen to that sound.
Irirangi Pōhō, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
So the government has announced a new department to plan the re-entry of the Pike River mine drift. Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern and the minister responsible for the effort, Andrew Little, yesterday said the Pike River Recovery Agency would be tasked with coming up with a plan by March 2019. Up to $23 million over 3 years will be budgeted to the new department, announced on the 7th anniversary of the disaster which killed 29 people. To hear more about this, we're joined by Andrew Little. How are you, Andrew?
I'm very well, thank you. Good afternoon.
Good. 1 second. So what will this standalone department be able to achieve that up to this point the Royal Commission can't have?
Well, the Royal Commission was really investigating to the best extent they could what happened and drew some conclusions about that. But they were never, you know, they didn't have any mandate to look at re-entering the mine or trying to recover anything from the mine. They just accepted whatever Pike River, the mine company, or anybody else told them was the case. This is really about setting up a project to re-enter the mine so that, if that's possible, then to look at whether there are any human remains in the drift, and if they are, they'd like to be at the far end, which hasn't been accessed so far. And then also to look at whether there's any evidence, anything that tells us more accurately what has happened, what the cause of the original explosion was. So this kind of goes beyond what the Royal Commission was ever set up to do.
Yeah, so in 2014, John Key said that Solid Energy did everything they could, and therefore the government had accepted the company's decision to abandon recovery efforts. And there certainly has been extensive efforts looking at coming up with a safe plan. Do you think that it's possible that it might not be possible to come up with a plan?
Well, look, anything is possible, you might say. I mean, and so in two respects, it is possible that actually we could re-enter the mine. And I've started going through a lot of the reports that the previous government got. And there are reports that say that, yep, you know, re-entry is feasible, technically feasible. There are some risks associated with it, and it's just a question of dealing with those risks. Thankfully, look, we could put a whole plan together and do all the risk assessment, and it is possible we get to the point where we say, you know, maybe this just isn't a goer. But until you actually approach it from the point of view we are determined to get in and do it, you actually don't know. And we haven't been down that path yet.
How significant are these risks that are outlined in that report?
The biggest risk, the reports I've said, say the biggest risk is rockfall. So, you know, there's a 2.3-kilometre tunnel you basically have to get through, and built on some of the land's reasonably unstable. So that, they say that is the biggest risk. There's a risk of gas and the atmosphere of the mine, but actually the science that I've read about it from the reports is that you can ventilate that mine. It takes a bit of effort and a bit of work, but you can ventilate it so that it is an atmosphere that is safe to go into.
Given that it's 2017, is there not some sort of technology that could re-enter the mine that would be safer than a manned entry?
Well, they've already sent, I think up to now, five robots, you know, tracked, little mini tracked vehicles have gone in. None of them have come out. Most of them have sent data back, it is true, they've sent images and things back, but they haven't been able to get back out of the mine. We also know that at around about 1,600 metres, there is a, what they call a loader, one of the mine, piece of mine equipment, that is stuck in the driftway, so you can't get past there anyway. We know that at one point they were looking at developing some device that could be dropped in through a borehole from the top of the mine, and that would kind of then transform itself, and that would kind of was around. It turned out that actually that technology hasn't been developed yet. It's in a prototype sort of stage. So actually, no, there isn't that technology that is reliable and durable. So I think, you know, that's why we focused our effort on an entry involving people.
So I understand that this agency is in partnership with the families of the Pike River, and how will the agency work with the families, and how will they be involved in the planning process? What have the conversations been like leading up to this announcement?
Oh, look, they'll be closely involved. I think part of the criticisms the families have had is that they haven't been involved. They've been kind of held at arm's length. And yet they've got a big stake in this. So I've made it as a principle for the officials in that arranging all this, setting up the agency and what the agency does. One of the operating principles is the families have to be integrally involved in it. And they will be, and they're looking forward to it. And look, they've got their own experts that have been helping them. So they have a lot to contribute to it. In the end, you know, there'll be a level of independence. There'll be an independent peer review of whatever plan is comes out of it. And then I will have somebody... just working to me as an advisor to the minister, who's independent of everything, to just as a check and a balance on the advice that I'm getting, to make sure that we get the best sort of assurance about the feasibility and safety of the plan.
We've had a lot of criticism from, it's had some criticism from National already, and I know that this is really been quite hurtful to some of the families. Is bringing this up in such a transparent way with such a sensitive issue really the best thing for those families?
That's what they want. They've wanted openness and transparency. And I've had quite a bit to do with the families, most of the families actually, since the explosion. And I was with them on the weekend on Sunday, met a lot of the family members, and look, they are thrilled that there is a level of openness about this. This is about helping them, you know, come to terms with what has happened. They still have a lot of unanswered questions. And the reality is that the National Party are in absolutely no position to make any criticism. They have fobbed those families off for the best part of 7 years and done them a disservice. So I take no criticism from the National Party at all.
And I just want to turn to one of your other roles, the Treaty Negotiations Minister. You've been given the name by Ngāpuhi Anuru Iti at a hui over the weekend. How did that go?
Well, the hui was good. I mean, Ngāpuhi is it's a very interesting iwi. It's unlike most of the other iwi around the country because they're very dispersed and they're very driven at the hapu level, which is kind of the level below the kind of the overarching iwi. And they've had long, you know, justified long-standing grievances, very serious ones actually. But we just haven't been able to kind of find the means or the basis on which to get around the table. And I've made it a priority for me as Treaty Negotiations Minister to really to get to understand Ngāpuhi, get to know the people, and find out a way that we can get around the table so the Crown can start to provide redress for the breaches of the treaty that it's committed, but most importantly that we can build an enduring relationship for the future and deal with some of the intractable problems in Northland and the far north. And build or rebuild, if you like, the treaty partnership that ought to prevail to help us deal with those issues.
Thank you very much, Andrew Little, for speaking with us. Hope you have a lovely day.
You too. See you then.
With a name like Sam Outlaw, you better make some of the best darn Baja-influenced country the world has ever seen. Lucky for Mr. Outlaw, he does. Sam on my way. And now he's heading to NZ. If you'd like to win yourself some tickets, stay tuned to 95BFM all this week. Sam Outlaw and Courtney Marie Andrews, November 30th at the Tuning Fork. Tickets from Ticketmaster.
Hey man, do you have anything by Eat, Pray, Hate? Sure. Coming up.
Oh, you're just gonna play it?
Yes.
You're not going to say it's not in the system, or you'll try find it, but you're not sure, or you don't take requests?
This is the request show.
Shit! When does the next show start?
Saturday, 7 to 9 p.m., the Jukebox Parlor is taking all your requests, and we know you have requests. Jukebox Parlor with Sung. Saturday, 7 to 9 p.m., only on 95 BFM.
The Wire.
I don't know, and frankly the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
It's 8 minutes to one. Before that, you heard Andrew Little speaking as Treaty Negotiations Minister and the Minister in charge of the Pike River Mine. A New Zealand academic says Confucius Institutes in the country serve at the behest of China's Communist Party. China's international education programs, including its Confucius Institutes, which offer language and cultural classes, are under global scrutiny as part of the country's growing soft power influence. There are several Confucius Institutes and partnered schools in New Zealand, universities, polytechnics and high schools, all of which are funded and supplied by China. An investigation this year by US education group, the National Association of Scholars, called for all universities in the country to close their Confucius Institutes because of risks to intellectual freedom. But how does this stack up in New Zealand? Well, I spoke to Catherine Churchman, a lecturer in Asian studies from Victoria University, which has its own Confucius Institute. And I began by asking her whether China really has influence over foreign universities through these programs.
They have a lot of influence over the institute itself. They pay for half of it usually, and they pay quite a lot of money. Because I know that they donate an awful lot of money to New Zealand universities. So Victoria got about $500,000 last year from the Chinese government. I just saw that figure. Now, they are controlled by Hanban, which is controlled by the Chinese Ministry of Education. But whether they don't really exercise direct control over what goes on inside the inside the institute, but they do have some rules around what you're allowed to teach there. So you have to teach, for example, if you're going to teach any kind of Chinese, you have to teach Mandarin. You're not allowed to teach Cantonese or Hokkien or any of these other Chinese languages, and you have to teach in the simplified character set.
And what's the significance
now,
of that?
In the 1950s, beginning in the 1950s, the Communist Party in China tried to simplify the way that the Chinese characters were constructed and write them with fewer strokes. They said it was out of promoting mass literacy. The original idea was actually to get rid of characters altogether and replace them with a romanized system of writing, but that eventually got scuppered and we got stuck with these simplified characters. Now, outside of China, so outside of the area that is controlled by the Communist Party, you have Taiwan and Hong Kong and Macau and Southeast Asia, where there are lots of Chinese communities as well. Right up until the 1980s in Southeast Asia, people just continued to use the traditional character set. But as countries with large Chinese populations, such as Malaysia, for example, Singapore, as they switched their allegiance to recognizing the People's Republic of China as the legitimate government of all China and had diplomatic relations, then they shifted as well. But generally what happened was outside China and in the US and even in New Zealand until relatively recently, all the newspapers and things that were written in Chinese by locals, they were written in the traditional character set, which the Taiwanese used. Now, many people can read both in China, but I think the level of literacy in the traditional character set is declining. The reason why it's important to be able to read traditional characters, and I guess this is what you were asking, is that there are things written, if you read Chinese and you can only read the simplified character set, then you can't really read stuff from Taiwan or Hong Kong. and many things from overseas Chinese newspapers and publications. Now, of course, people can just use software to switch them over a bit, but there are still books and information written about the history of the Communist Party and about internal affairs in China that are only written in that character set and were written outside China. And that's quite important because of the censorship that the Chinese Communist Party has over things written inside China.
Right.
It's so still it's quite important to be able to read those. Yeah?
So it's promoting a sort of semi-literacy that's in China's interests?
Well, that's what I argued, that the Confucius Institutes want to teach people to know things, but they don't want them to know too much. Once you start, imagine if you had 1,000 New Zealanders who were like not of Chinese background, who could read and write and speak fluently in Chinese, then they might actually cause more trouble in the local community because they can look at things that are printed in China and point out where they're inaccurate. And,
The US seems particularly concerned about CIs because, you know, we've had a lot of reports come out this year and media coverage. There's been groups calling for all CIs in the States to be shut down because they suppress academic freedom. And there's talk of, you know, them constituting foreign interference in the country's education system. Yeah, I mean, do you think this is really the extent of how much influence they carry, or is this perhaps overblown?
Well, I don't know about exactly what is happening in the U.S. As far as New Zealand is concerned, I think it is overblown because they don't, they even though they are inside universities and give funding to universities, they're kept very separate from the Chinese teaching programs. So they don't, you don't actually get teachers from the Confucius Institute coming in and teaching Chinese to the undergrads. So one of the things, I think the problem will come, and what people are worried about, is that universities love to save money. And the best way to save money is to not have to pay for your lecturers. You only have to pay for half a lecturer or half a teaching assistant or something like that. And that's very appealing for a university that wants to save money. They can get these people to teach Chinese and teach Chinese history and teach Chinese culture and so on for half the price.
So if this were to extend further than, you know, the amount...
at the moment.
Yeah.
Then there's a problem. But I can't see that happening at the moment, but it's something to look out for. Usually when you're going to hear about these things, then the decision's already been made. But it did happen in Newcastle University, where they ended up just farming up the Chinese language courses to the Confucius Institute. So I don't know whether they have Chinese lecturers there anymore.
That was The Wire.
Yes, indeed. That was The Wire, bringing us to the end of another show. Thanks to all those who spoke with us during the show today. Jack Heineman, Lynn Parent, Stephen Petch, Regina Izert, Andrew Little and Catherine Churchman. A big thanks to my producers Lucy, Mac and Connor. But most importantly, thank you all for listening. I'm Reuben McLaren. Jen is up next with the 1 to 4.